So, hey, everybody, this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, streaming live on the web, kpfk.org. And please register on our site, www.voicesfromthefrontlines.com. We have a really good guest today, Therese Ehrlich, who's written a very important new book called Inside Syria, The Backstory of the Civil War and What the World Can Expect. So we're on with Therese Ehrlich. He and I have known each other for a long time. He starts a lot of his life with Stop the Draft Week in Oakland, which is very important. We've worked together in many contexts. He's a journalist and a revolutionary, basically, and he writes about a lot about the Middle East in a very journalistic, political fashion. And he's got a new book called Inside Syria, The Backstory of the Civil War and What the World Can Expect. Reese, nice to have you on Voices from the Front Lines.
My real pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with the fact that for a lot of us, it's hard to unravel the different forces on the ground. Without going into the backstory, what's the front story? If you were explaining to us, what are the forces and how do they perceive themselves? Before we get into how the United States perceives them.
Well, in the beginning of the uprising in Syria in 2011, there were two main forces. The civil society activists, kind of the same kind of people who participated in Occupy or who are out in the streets now around Ferguson, who are against the dictatorship, and conservative Islamic forces like the Muslim Brotherhood, but not the extremists that we see today. As the Assad government cracked down quite brutally on all protesters, the people turned towards armed struggle, and without getting too complicated, the extreme right-wing forces claiming to be fighting for Islam have taken control, have taken the initiative, let's say. The people on the ground, much of the opposition considers itself to be fighting for Islam, but like Christianity or Judaism, there's a big difference between what's written in the book or the religion teaches and how it can be interpreted politically. And that's exactly what we're seeing now with on the ground in Syria. Assad continues to have some support, particularly among Christians and Shia Muslims and other minorities, Alawites, because they see the extremist forces as being a real threat to their very existence. So Assad is hanging in there, but he only controls about a third of the country now.
Well, that was great as an opening. Now, let's superimpose, of course, the superpower, the United States. I think we both know, and I'm sure you go into it in great deal in your book, how the United States has opportunistically backed virtually every faction in the Middle East, giving weapons often to all of them. What do you see as U.S. objectives right now on the three forces? And the parenthesis is, are there still, whatever those civil society forces are, do they have an armed reflection, or have they been pushed out of the scene?
They, to my knowledge, do not have an armed group. The civil society activists who are not in the pay of the United States are engaged in civilian activities like healthcare, education, things like that in rebel-controlled areas. But to my knowledge, none of them have an armed group. The United States initially actually supported Assad, contrary to the myths that spread by some, because he was the devil they knew. But when they thought Assad would fall, the U.S. opportunistically called for his downfall and tried all the usual methods that have worked in some cases in the past, funding and arming a militia group, creating a phony civilian coalition, trying to work with minority groups. And it's not the fact that Obama lacked the will or was wishy-washy or a wuss or something like that. He did everything imperial presidents are supposed to do, and they failed, because it's very difficult to find people in Syria who want to back the United States. They see what happened in Iraq, they see what happened in Afghanistan, and they don't want to see that happen again in their own country.
Well, one of the things, Reese, that, and again, we're very happy, this is Reese Ehrlich, who's on Voices from the Frontline. He's got an important book out called Inside Syria, The Backstory of the Civil War and What the World Can Expect. You can't judge a book by its cover. It's a very beautiful cover. And in terms of folks thinking about holiday gifts, I'm going to come back to that. I also make sure that I announce twice, because Reese is a very good organizer, that Reese Ehrlich is going to be speaking tomorrow, Wednesday, December 3rd. And from 12 to 3, keynote speaker, Cal State Long Beach, at the Student Union and at the Beach Auditorium. So if you're in the East LA, oh, I'm sorry, if you're in the Long Beach area, I was thinking of Cal State LA. If you're in the Long Beach area, check this out. Then, December 4th, which is my birthday, not that important, at 7 p.m. there's a KPFK benefit at Throop Unitarian Church, 300 South Robles in Pasadena. And then, on December 5th, which is Friday, I believe, he's speaking at the Levantine Center, 5998 Pico Boulevard in L.A. So between Long Beach, Pasadena, where is it in Pico?
Fairfax District.
Oh, okay, cool. So it's in the Fairfax District. So one of those choices, folks, why don't you try to turn out and listen to Reese? He's a real good speaker. And we also know that people who have books need support. So as the United States...
I wish you a happy birthday, Eric. I had no idea it was coming up.
Thanks, Reese.
And I'm not going to even ask you how old you are.
No, I'm 72. So how's that? I'm doing great. So that's the most important thing.
Great.
So, why did I open another can of worms, right? So never ask a question you don't want the answer to. In terms of U.S. interests, I mean, one of the things I'm trying to figure out, Reese, is that the United States goes in. We're talking about now Afghanistan, Iraq, causes phenomenal human destruction, plays around with different forces, essentially has to declare defeat, leaves, then replays the other forces as it's leaving. How would you see that analogy in Syria right now? Do you think that's a fair analogy?
Yeah, I think the U.S. Doesn't lose wars. We all know that, even in the face of the objective reality.
Right.
So what the U.S. is doing in Iraq right now is an attempt to win back some of the losses that it took in the 10 years of the Iraq War, initiated, of course, by George Bush. So we're seeing that in Syria as well. The U.S. is in a bind because all the efforts it made to find some kind of significant force on the ground that would back the U.S. policies has failed. And extremists who are genuinely both anti-people, anti-U.S., and anti-Assad, pretty much anti-everybody, anti-other rebels, are at least for the moment, in the ascendancy in Syria. So the U.S. is in a real bind. It would like to play forces off against each other like it does historically, but... They're just floundering around. The latest plan, Turkey and the U.S. discussed establishing a no-fly zone inside northern Syria, in which the U.S. would attack all the Assad air force and knock out their air defenses, and then create an area where rebel groups friendly to the U.S. and Turkey could assemble and launch attacks. The U.S. is, at least at the moment, unwilling to do that because of the very serious consequences that would have. That would mean very likely a commitment ultimately of U.S. troops to fighting in Syria, because if it didn't work, then you got to send in troops, just like they're doing in Iraq.
Well, to take this even broader geopolitically, do you think that the United States' obviously obsession with the Middle East, because of obviously it's both strategic, we understand all the arguments, is actually helping the People's Republic of China, is even helping Russia, because the United States really, despite what it's promising with its $700 billion and more defense budget, cannot really fight on all these fronts. There's no popular support for this. So I'm asking, as China is certainly very aggressive internationally, the United States said it wanted to be a Pacific power, and, you know, the same thing with the Soviets and the Ukraine. Do you think that in some way...
I believe they're the Russians, not the Soviets.
I'm sorry. Sorry. The Russians. Thank you. Old habits die hard. So the Russians in Ukraine and the Chinese, and I'm not always saying that everything the Chinese are doing is good, but they're phenomenally aggressive in Latin America, in Southeast Asia. Do you think that the United States is, one, continuing to make the Middle East its obviously main area of intervention, And do you think this weakens the United States in a good way to prevent it from intervening in other places in the world?
Yes and yes. This is, we're seeing what an empire in decline looks like. It proclaims military power all over the world, but in reality can't do it. And the Obama administration announced plans, remember, to pivot towards Asia.
Right.
It was going to decrease its commitments in Iraq and Afghanistan and move to... Well, they can't do it. Those wars won't give up. They're keeping troops fighting longer in Afghanistan than originally planned, and they've reinvaded Iraq with now 3,000 troops, supposedly non-combat troops, and we know where that's going. And at the same time, yes, when one empire is weakened, other forces tend to fill the gap. So both Russia, China, and Iran are all benefiting from this disastrous latest war and previous wars by the United States. And I would make an important... I'm very critical of many policies in China, but they are not a military superpower. They're not sending 7 aircraft fleets around the world. They don't have troops stationed outside their borders. And they are an economic competitor with the United States, that's for sure. But that's very different than being portrayed as the next frightening military superpower, as is being promoted in the U.S.
Well, I think that's very important, because in terms of the two concepts that we're both working with, as seriously as the United States is declining superpower, which it took me a little bit to understand that's what was happening. But obviously we see the complete disintegration of the safety net at home, the complete disintegration of even the promise of a, forget about full employment economy, of a basic employment economy, the destruction of the wage scale, massive racial struggle, massive expansion of the police in an insane level. Where do you think, given your book, let's go back to your book, if we're both saying the United States is a declining superpower, who should we be rooting for simply by their own contradiction to the United States?
Well, one thing I learned a long time ago, just because the U.S. is fighting somebody doesn't make them a good guy.
Right.
Think of Saddam Hussein.
Oh, I totally agree with that.
Right? And there's nothing wrong with opposing both the United States policies and the local dictators. In fact, I think that's what left and progressive forces should do. And in the case of Assad, he is a brutal dictator. And there's some people who try to argue that somehow he's an anti-imperialist, or he's supporting the Palestinians, or one thing or another. The Palestinians hate Assad. They're fighting in one of the areas of Damascus right now against Assad and his allies in Damascus. On the earlier point that you were making, I think that the current war, just the current fighting in Iraq and Syria, is going to cost $5 billion for this year alone. And that amount for sure is a low-ball estimate, and it for sure is going to go up. And where exactly is this money going to come from? $5 billion is actually serious money, especially when it becomes 10 or 20 or 30 billion. And when you go to get money for education or health care or all the things that we really need, it's not available because we have to have a balanced budget. But suddenly there's unlimited funds available for a war that's even for sure to be lost, and for sure to hurt the people of the region and in the United States.
Well, one of the things that I'd like to question is, when you said that we have to both fight against the United States and the dictators, the problem with that, Reese, is that if we have very little power to figure out what to do about Assad or Hussein, but if the United States uses the fact that we're so-called working against those dictators, and those dictators change every day, doesn't it create the basis for still supporting U.S. hegemony, which is what they would argue back from the human rights point of view or other things? How do you fight that war on both fronts?
As a practical matter, we live in the United States.
Right.
When we go out and picket or hold a sit-in or whatever, we're protesting U.S. policies. That's the reality of it. We have a little bit of impact on U.S. policy. We have zero impact on Assad's policy as a practical matter. But I think it is important, because whatever administration is in power, Bush or Obama or whoever comes to power after that, they always try to paint the left and progressive and liberals as supporting the other side. You have to remember, you're either with us or against us,
yep,
as Bush said. So by the logic that we have to be worried about ending up siding with the U.S., we would have had to support Saddam Hussein. And that's crazy. We all opposed the Iraq War without calling for support for Hussein, and the fact that he's gone is, you know, part of history in Iraq, but it's certainly not something that we dictated that we would never have, I certainly never supported. So, well, you know, the same thing with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Because the Taliban is the most effective fighting force against the U.S., should we support the Taliban? I don't think so.
Well, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is just the opposite in some ways, that if the demand is for self-determination, after demand is saying, look, yes, we shouldn't support the Taliban, but nor should we most of the time be supporting any other forces in Afghanistan or Iraq. The big thing is get the U.S. out. And if they say, well, what do you think about the Taliban? My answer is, well, can't the people of Afghanistan solve that? And not simply because I'm being isolationist, mm-hmm. but because I believe in the concept of self-determination. And in that way, if they say, well, what if the Taliban win? I say, well, that's real people in Afghanistan who waged a force against the, you know, they built a movement around ideas that I don't necessarily agree with, but it's forces in Afghanistan that are going to have to solve that. And what I'm getting to, and we don't have to, is if we don't take a super hard line on sovereignty and self-determination, I think we still ask the U.S. to come in the front door, and there's a chance we open the possibility of them coming in the back door.
I agree. That is, the people of Afghanistan, of Iraq and Syria, have to resolve their issues on their own, and that as horrible as the Taliban is, I don't think they're going to be able to stay in power forever, and same thing with ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. These are horrible groups distorting Islam for their own political purposes, but if the people of the region resolve these issues on their own, the solution is going to be far more lasting than anything imposed. The United States cannot impose a political settlement on those countries.
Last thing, Reese, is how's the book war going?
The book war?
Yeah, you know, authors getting books sold. Do people show up when they say?
Yeah, I have been pleasantly surprised. I've been doing this for a long time, as you know.
Yep.
And I've had huge crowds, actually, show up. This is the third month of my book tour. I've spoken in the Bay Area, all over the East Coast. I'll be in L.A., of course, starting tomorrow. And I'll be in the Midwest in January and February. Part of it is that it's very timely. The book is very timely, and the issues with the bombing and the new war in Iraq and Syria, people are very, very much interested. And I'm drawing an interesting mixture, not only kind of the traditional peace activists and the older folks, but a lot of young people, a lot of students, a lot of Palestinians, Syrians, Iraqis, and Iranians, and Kurds, and people from the Middle East who have their roots there. And I spoke at places like Stanford and MIT and Harvard, and much to my surprise, I wasn't lynched by the reactionary faculty. There's a core of solid progressive folks on campuses around the country, and I see the very, very beginnings of an anti-war movement. There's an education process going on now to kind of sort out what's going on over there, and as the war escalates, which I think it will, I think we're going to see more protests against it.
Reese Ehrlich, very nice to have you on the show. He's going to be in Long Beach. He's going to be in the Fairfax area. He's going to be in Pasadena. And you heard the information. Call the station, 818-985-5735, if you want to get it again. And Reese Ehrlich, very nice to have you on the show.
I appreciate you having me on.
Of course, man. Talk
and
to you soon.
Birthday.
Thanks.